Hello, welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of January 30th through February 6th. And we're very pleased to have with us today Timothy Burns, professor of political science at Colgate University and author of the book Reverse Mission, Transnational Religious Communities and the Making of U.S. Foreign Policy. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Welcome. And we're very excited to have you here because you have a very interesting story to tell, and part of it involves the Jesuits, which is obvious interest to us. But maybe first you can kind of tell the story behind this title and, you know, what you were interested when you set about writing this.
Okay, well, the title is Reverse Mission, and that's actually a phrase from Maryknoll nuns who talk about coming back from the field to evangelize Americans about what's going on in the various places where they serve. So many people will remember from their childhood, decades before, nuns coming back and talking at churches, at schools, etc., about the life that they were leading with the people in mission. And what I'm referring to here is a more political process of these nuns living in a context where American foreign policy was having an influence on the people that they were serving. And so they decided to try to come back to the United States and inform and educate Americans about what was done, quote, in their name, particularly in places like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. And so I expanded that concept of reverse mission to encompass three communities, the Maryknolls, as you mentioned, the Jesuits, and also Benedictines.
And you tell an interesting story at the beginning in your preface about early on in your academic career, you were looking at the situation of Vietnam and the situation of U.S. involvement in Central America. And as you say, there were a lot of similarities, but there was one big difference, which is kind of the impetus for this book. Maybe you can talk about that.
Right. I actually examined American foreign policy towards Vietnam in the early 1960s and American policy towards El Salvador in the early 1980s. During the it was, you know, contemporary to that. It was in the early 80s. And the only major difference was that the so-called Catholic lobby was pushing particular President Kennedy to support the Catholic Diem in Vietnam against the communist Ho Chi Minh. So it was a very kind of bellicose pro-war group. Where in the early 80s, the only that I could find, the only organized opposition really to President Reagan's policies in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras in the early 80s was nuns. And they were very outspoken and very controversial. And I noticed that, this was in 1984 and 85, that was a significant change that had taken place in the role of American Catholic organized interest. And so as I say in the preface, I won't go on to it here, is a long story about why it took me almost 30 years. I wrote a lot of other things, got interested in other things, and then I came back to that question in this book.
And it actually served you well because you were able to have a little perspective on the whole question. We're going to talk mostly about the Jesuit story today, and I would recommend folks to read the other stories as well. But maybe you could talk briefly about one of the interesting elements here is how the charisms of these different religious communities affected their kind of political action.
Right. That's really one of the central arguments of the book, that the various charisms, founding traditions, and what I call transnational structures of these communities actually shape the way in which they engage in politics. So very quickly, Jesuits, for example, are a transnational group of men, mostly associated in educational apostolates around the world. And the way they engage in politics is to organize themselves and to actually sort of lobby, to go to congressmen, often who have attended Jesuit universities, and to try to advance the interests of people that way. Whereas we mentioned before, the missionaries from Maryknoll, when they engage in politics, they do so in a missionary way. They evangelize the American population about what's going on in these places. And the Benedictines, as I say in the book, one's tempted to say, well, they pray about it, but actually they do more than that. They construct relationships of hospitality across international borders, and these Benedictines that I studied have a home that they operate in Cuernavaca, Mexico, where they try to introduce North Americans to what they call the reality of poverty in Mexico.
So we'll turn here to the story of the Jesuit. As the chapter is called Martyrdom in El Salvador, Mobilization in the U.S., for those who may not be familiar with the history here, what happened to the Jesuits in 1989?
Okay, in November 1989, a group of soldiers from the Salvadoran army went into the University of Central America, the UCA, in San Salvador in the middle of the night. They roused six Jesuits from their beds, laid them out face down on a lawn outside their home, and put a bullet in the back of each one of their heads. This army was then receiving millions of dollars from the United States government. And so the Jesuits in El Salvador banded with the Jesuits in the United States to try to bring pressure on the Salvadoran government to actually investigate and solve the crime, because lots of, you can imagine, stories were made up about who had actually killed the Jesuits, and pressure on the U.S. government to use their influence on the Salvadoran government in that direction, but also to cut off funds to the Salvadoran military in the 1980s. Because this army that had murdered these Jesuits was basically a fully funded subsidiary of the U.S. government. And so you had people in the United States who were mobilized by Jesuits saying, basically, our government is killing our brother Jesuits in El Salvador. So it was a very strong mobilization on the part of the Society of Jesus.
Yes, and some of the people who were involved in that story live in this house, so we'll talk a bit about that in a moment. But you talk about how these murders were in many ways a direct challenge to not just the Jesuits in El Salvador, but to those specifically in the United States.
Well, one of the things also that's at the heart of the book is the idea of transnational identity, right? So that if you are a member of the Society of Jesus, a U.S. citizen who's also a Jesuit, you have a kind of connection with people in El Salvador that, for example, the average American doesn't have. I remember quite well when these Jesuits were murdered in 1989, and I felt bad about it. I was outraged that such a thing would happen. But I didn't think of these murdered men as my brothers, as someone that I had a deep fraternal relationship with. So the Jesuits in the U.S. found this, I think, to be a really important challenge to them politically, that how could they remain silent in the face of a political dynamic whereby a government that they were paying taxes to, that they were citizens of, that they were in some way tacitly supporting, was actively engaged in supporting a government that was brutally murdering their brother Jesuits. This wasn't a kind of far away, sort of vague dynamic. This was their government supporting an army that was killing their brothers.
And there's a very interesting dynamic that you note here, kind of two separate dynamics in the Jesuits at the time. One is the kind of impetus that came from Pedro Arrupe, focused more on questions of justice, and that inspired people like those Jesuits in El Salvador. But you also had the traditional Jesuit model in this country of being in higher education and educating some of the kind of upper echelon of society. Those two dynamics kind of met in this situation.
Yeah, it's very interesting about the Jesuits, I think. This event took place within the context of a debate, particularly in the United States, but not just in the United States, about what it means to actually be a Jesuit university, right? So if you're a Jesuit working on a soup line somewhere, or you're working in a parish in a poor neighborhood, it's quite easy to advance the faith and justice traditions of Arrupe and the Jesuits of that type. But if you're the president of Georgetown University, or you're the president of Boston College, what does it mean to actually be serving faith and justice? And so the rector and professors at the University of Central America in El Salvador were very closely associated with this idea of using the resources and institutions of the university to advance justice in their society. So when those very men were killed for doing that exact thing, that was an even more, I think, significant challenge for people like presidents of Fordham, Georgetown, Boston College. What did their university mean, and how could they use the positions they held in American society to try to advance justice, at least in this case, but certainly even broadly?
Well, I mentioned the Jesuits who live here took part in the story. One is Father Joe O'Hare, former president of Fordham, and Father Leo O'Donovan, former president of Georgetown. What roles did they play?
Well, they were both significant for two reasons. One was they occupied positions of great prominence in the American higher education community, right? Particularly in Georgetown. Father O'Donovan was the president of Georgetown. And so he published an op-ed piece in the Washington Post within 2 days of the murders in El Salvador. And this is an example I use in the book of the kind of access that these sort of men have to the avenues of power in the United States. But it was also interesting in O'Donovan's case that the president of El Salvador at the time, Man and Christiani, was actually a graduate of Georgetown University. So that kind of is symbolic of the kind of connections I'm talking about. And then O'Hare was asked by the provincial to give the sermon at the mass in honor of these men who were killed in El Salvador. And he gave a very dramatic sermon about how there were blood on the hands of Americans who were supporting the government in El Salvador. And then O'Hare was also part of a group of Jesuits who went down to El Salvador to offer their support to the Jesuits in El Salvador at the time. And just interestingly enough, that trip was also covered by 60 Minutes. So O'Hare was also interviewed on CBS News. So at the time, it was quite a cause célèbre.
I want to talk a bit about Dean Brackley, who is somebody who plays a prominent role in this story and just passed away since the book was published. So Right. Maybe you can introduce him and the role of him and his brother Jesuits following this murder.
Right. Brackley was working in the Bronx at the time, and he and a man named Charlie Byrne, who was then the academic vice president at Santa Clara University, were chosen by the heads of the Jesuit community in Rome to go to El Salvador as they said, while the blood was still on the walls, to replace the men who had been running the university. Brackley was a very interesting fellow. I interviewed him a couple of times in El Salvador for this book. He's the only one who's still there. He went in 1989 and then spent the rest of his life there. As you say, he just recently died. And he talked about it in a very interesting way as sort of paying reparations as an American. When I asked him these questions, I thought he would be more hesitant to talk in this way. But he really saw his role in El Salvador, not in a specifically political sense, but as someone coming from the United States of America to offer his support to the Salvadoran Jesuits and the Salvadoran people quite explicitly as an American, saying, okay, I understand what's being done by my government in this context, and I would like to come and support my brother Jesuits, but I would also like to come symbolically and represent, I think, another face of Americans.
Now, he played a role in what is probably, as you note, the strongest connection with this piece of history, which is the University of Santa Clara and this program they have down there.
Brackley started something called the Casa Solidaridad, and many of your listeners will know that many, many these days college students go abroad their junior year, and they go to London, and they go to Rome, and now some of them go to South Africa, and some of them go wherever they go. And Brackley thought it would be a good idea for students of Jesuit universities in the United States to be introduced to the kind of mission that was taking place at the UCA in San Salvador. So the Casa Solidaridad, which is run out of Santa Clara in California, sends a group of students, 12, 15 each year. They live in a home together with Salvadoran students who are attending the UCA, and they go to classes there, and they also work in service projects around San Salvador. And I visited that house when I was there once, and it's quite an impressive place. It's quite different than the experience that most students have when they study abroad.
Maybe we could return to the history here. You know, what happened following the murders? You mentioned the Jesuits were involved in this kind of coordinated effort. There was also an American congressional delegation.
Right. There was, and it was sent by the leadership of the House of Representatives, led by a man named Joe Moakley from Massachusetts. And they were sort of an interesting sort of seat-of-the-pants group of people, particularly Moakley. He was from Massachusetts. He represented many Catholics in his district. And they were, I think, shocked to find how direct the relationship was between the U.S. government and the Salvadoran military. As Moakley said at one point, these people are killing priests. This is not a complicated situation. They are murdering priests. Now, there were several different strands, as you mentioned. One was Byrne and Brackley actually going to the UCA and joining its administration. Another was, I talk about in the book, a complex set of financial machinations where they were trying to construct a set of financial autonomous conditions for the new university leadership. And then the third, and in the long run, probably the most important, was this sort of mobilization, what I would call lobbying effort, by the Jesuits in the U.S. to pressure the U.S. government to cut off funds to the Salvadoran military.
What happened in terms of the political history in El Salvador following these murders? Were these folks brought to justice?
No. There was a trial which was held in El Salvador. Interestingly, Don Monin, who was then, I think, just retired as president of BC, went to El Salvador and attended the trial every day. It was basically a sham. What they did was they convicted a couple of very low-level officials of being complicit in the murder, but only, and this is a really very sort of bizarre story, they were only convicted for murdering this young girl who happened to be staying at the house that night. So as Charlie Byrne says, apparently killing Jesuits was okay, but if you kill this cook's daughter. And none of the Jesuits in El Salvador said that they wanted to bring to justice what they call the intellectual authors of the crime. And that went at least as high as the Ministry of Defense in the Salvadoran military, probably to the president's office. None of those people were ever brought to justice. As a matter of fact, many of them remain quite prominent figures in El Salvador today.
You mentioned that, but the UN did have a commission which identified some of these people as you say, intellectual authors.
Right. There was a truth commission after the end of the Civil War in El Salvador which did identify them, but none of them went to jail.
Now, the Civil War ended in 92. As you write in your book, it's hard to draw a direct line between the murders and the ending of this conflict, but there were some forces. This was a major event.
Yes, it was. There's a wonderful line from another book where they say, and then came the Jesuits. And I really adopt this as an argument. I agree with you. It's very difficult to talk about direct causation. But I also say in the book that if the military in El Salvador wanted to do the stupidest thing they could possibly do, it would have been to kill the Jesuits. Because in doing so, they killed people who had an extremely strong transnational brotherhood with people in the United States who had significant influence and access to power. And so the negotiations to end the Civil War, which is what the priests at the UCA had been calling for all along, were actually greatly energized by the mobilization by people like Pat Moynihan, Chris Dodd, Pat Leahy, all these people who had close relations with the Jesuits in the U.S., who worked quite assiduously in those months and years in Congress to pressure the Salvadoran military to open up peace talks with the rebels.
And you mentioned some of those folks. On the U.S. scene, people were specifically, you know, on the floor of Congress invoking the Jesuits, Nancy Pelosi being among those, saying, you know, we're part of the Jesuit family, we need to act.
Yes, very much so. I had a very interesting period of time when I was doing the research for this book of actually, I don't recommend your listeners do it, but reading the congressional record. And you would find fascinating statements. Nancy Pelosi, for example, her district includes the University of San Francisco, which is very involved in this action at the time. And you had people from Seattle and many, many other places where there were Jesuit universities who would pressure the members of Congress to associate themselves with the Jesuit community and with what was going on in Central America.
Now, one piece of story that kind of interests me as somebody who's been working at a Jesuit institution now for 5 or 6 years is it's very impressive that there was this coordinated effort that went on among the various universities and the Jesuit assistancy. Some people would say that it's very difficult to do that under other circumstances because the network is so diffuse. You've got these individual institutions. There are these kind of silo walls that separate them. Are there kind of missed opportunities you could point to or in terms of like using the Jesuit voice to lobby on behalf of certain subjects?
Yeah, I think, you know, I hesitate to say, Tim, to be honest with you, not being a Jesuit, and you should ask them. But it seems to me that this event was so galvanizing for them and across many divisions. You know, it's very interesting. I was surprised that most of the Jesuits that I spoke to didn't know each other. You know, you talk to the president of this university, he didn't know the president of that university. They grow up mostly in provinces, they associate with each other. There's a division, for example, that some of your listeners may be aware of sometimes between Jesuits who teach in high schools and Jesuits who teach in universities and how they articulate the mission. And I don't think, again, you should ask Jesuits, but I don't think there is often this kind of cohesive, every Jesuit basically, I'm sure there was one or two, but every Jesuit woke up that morning, looked at his newspaper and said, hold on a second, 6 of ours, the word they use, which I use in the book, were just murdered in El Salvador this morning. How could that possibly happen? How can I call myself a member of this transnational brotherhood, this society, without taking actions within the channels that are available to me? I don't study them as a full-time professional, but I don't see the Jesuits being that cohesive and that energetic on a set of other issues.
Of course, you can see why. It was such a dramatic event where 6 people were literally gunned down. I mean, right. It's hard to imagine another scenario, God willing, that would like that.
Right, exactly. So I'm not being critical of them, but it's interesting. I do make the point in the book, without being critical of the Jesuits, that I think the Marinol reaction to what goes on in the places where they live, that the association that the missionaries have with the people that they accompany. There are many Jesuits who have that kind of experience, of course, and who articulate their mission in that way. But I think the sort of congregational mission and the way Marinols talk about it tends to be more closely associated with what's happening to the people in their communities and less to what's happening to themselves.
Well, why don't we end by talking a bit about Marinol? Because the Marinol sisters are celebrating their 100th anniversary this year. I think they just had a celebratory liturgy just a couple weeks ago. And since mission is so central to what they do, it's part of their charism, maybe you could talk a bit more about them and how, you know, they try to use their influence.
Yeah, it's very similar timeline. You look at Arupe and the congregations that the Jesuits held in the 60s and 70s about redefining their mission. Yet a similar process go on in the Marinols, where the traditional role of mission, you know, if you look back at the original documents of the Marinol group, basically to baptize pagan babies, you know, in places like China. And I think over the past 30 or 40 years, you've had a really significant change in that. And so they don't see their mission anymore to go and bring about, you know, baptisms of non-Catholics. As a matter of fact, many of the places where they live, most of the people they interact with are already baptized Catholics. But what they talk about is accompanying the poor. This nun that I interviewed in El Salvador, for example, said something that stuck with me. I said, as I would ask all of them, you know, why are you here? What are you doing? What is this all about? And she said, I try to find the poorest people I can find, and I move in next door to them. And so what they do is they accompany, what they call accompany the poor in these places. They share the sufferings. They share the deprivations of these people. They share the death and murder, for example. A couple of Maryknoll nuns, as many of your listeners will know, were killed in El Salvador. And what they do is that identification and association of the people leads them, as one of the nuns I spent quite a bit of time to say, my government, the U.S. government, was killing my people, the people on the Honduran Nicaraguan government during the Contra War, and I had to do something about it. And so what they can do is they're not the president of Georgetown, they're not the president of Boston College, but what they can do is exercise their missionary zeal, their missionary action, to come back to the United States, travel around to parishes, schools, library reading groups, anyone who would listen to them, where they would talk about what they saw as the true reality. You remember at that time, Ronald Reagan was calling the contra-revolutionary forces in Nicaragua the moral equivalent of the founding fathers. And the idea that these Nicaraguans were actually great heroes of democracy and freedom. And these nuns were living in communities where they viewed the Contras as terrorist murders. That was their view of them, very bluntly. And so they came back to the United States to try to argue that what was actually happening in these places with the tax dollars of American Catholics was not consistent with what their president was saying.
And as I mentioned before, your final chapter, I don't want to leave them out, talks about the Benedictines and some of their outreach to folks on Mexico and on the border. Maybe you can talk briefly about
that. Yeah, the Benedictines, I think, Tim, are really interesting because their notion of politics is so different than anyone else's, right? It's very long-term. It's very people-to-people. And I studied a monastery called the Western Priory. Some of your listeners may be familiar with their music. And they established many years ago what they call an alianza with a group of with Benedictine nuns in Mexico City. And their action is constructed on the Benedictine principle of hospitality. And so they opened their house as a sanctuary to Guatemalan refugees. They work very closely with these Benedictine nuns to try to support the people that the nuns work with in Mexico. And some years ago, they founded a house, sort of like a retreat house in Cuernavaca, Mexico, where people from the United States mostly go on a 10-day faith and hospitality experience, where the sisters who are associated with the priory in Vermont try to, what they call, introduce U.S. citizens to the reality of poverty. And it's quite a political thing, actually, in the sense that if you go there, which I did, I went on the experience, they try to make connections for us between the economic, political, and social policies of the U.S. government and the poverty of the people in Mexico. Not in the same sense that you're supposed to go home and call your congressman and change policy, but to try to, in what they would consider a Benedictine sense of solidarity and hospitality, to educate American citizens, again, about what's being done in their name in Latin America.
Well, this is a very rich story you have to tell of all of these communities, and I would recommend our listeners to pick up this book. And we want to thank Timothy Burns for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.